Thanks, Nicole. So today I'm going to talk. So I'm the only non-regulator up here. So I'm going to talk about something different. I'm going to talk about mortgage arrears, and why I'm going to talk about mortgage arrears. You all as banks should be interested in mortgage arrears, but they're an important indicator of the financial health of households. Have implications for our assessment of current economic conditions and the outlook. And they're also clearly an important indicator of the financial health of those writing the mortgages, be it banks or non-banks. And draw on some material we put out in October in the Financial Stability Review and a speech given recently by my colleague John Kearns. So the mortgage arrears rate nationally is 1%, which is low by both historical standards in Australia and international standards. So to put that in context, arrears in the US peaked about a bit over a decade ago at around 10% in the financial crisis. So peaked at 10 in the US, it's 1 here. So non-performing loans currently pose little risk to the health of financial institutions. And that's not surprising in an environment where the unemployment rate is relatively low and interest rates have been declining. Nonetheless, the arrears rate has been increasing steadily over recent years to the highest it's been for around a decade. And so you can't just ignore that. So while the national arrears rate is low, in some parts of the country, households have found it harder to keep up with their mortgage payments. And the largest increase in housing loan arrears has occurred in WA and in the Northern Territory, where economic conditions have been weak and the unemployment rate has risen. And so developments in WA and the Northern Territory show how arrears can evolve in adverse economic circumstances. So it's worth looking into what's gone on there to give some idea about what could, although probably don't think it will, happen at the national level. So in WA, for those of you who don't know, the unemployment rate has risen from 4% to 6% over the last few years. Housing prices have fallen by 20% so far. Incomes have declined, and strong inward migration for a number of years turned around to strong outward migration. Such that population growth in WA declined from being over 3% a few years back to being under 1%. So those conditions have seen the mortgage arrears rate rise from about 70 basis points to about 180 basis points, 1.8% today. So that's a significant rise and associated with financial stress for a number of households. But still, at 1.8%, given the economic circumstances that have evolved, it's not that high. So as I'm sure you all know, borrowers can fall behind on their mortgages for a number of reasons. The vast majority of people who fall behind on their mortgages do so because of an unexpected loss of all or part of their income. And common reasons for this are the loss of a job, ill health, or relationship breakdown. And that's going to occur even when economic conditions and lending standards are good. So there's always going to be a baseline level of mortgage arrears. Indeed, from a system-wide perspective, or even an individual bank perspective, a mortgage arrears rate of zero is undesirable, because it would imply that lending standards were too tight and that creditworthy borrowers were being denied access to credit. Widespread increases in arrears, rather than idiosyncratic ones, are driven by macro factors, in particular rising unemployment rates, which lead to a widespread loss of income, rising interest rates, which create a higher regular expense for borrowers, and falling house prices, which can make it more difficult for borrowers who are behind on their payments to get out of arrears by selling their property. Appropriate lending standards that ensure that borrowers have reasonable income and equity buffers can mitigate the impact of macro factors on arrears, while poor lending standards amplify their effect. So in all states currently, increases in the share of housing loans that are more than 90 days in arrears have been mainly driven by loans remaining in arrears for longer rather than by more loans entering arrears. So if you think about it, arrears is a stock. So the inflow of new loans into arrears actually hasn't picked up all that much over the last little while. The reason why the arrears rate has gone up nationally is because mortgages are staying in arrears for longer and they're not resolving and getting out of arrears. So it suggests that households are finding it harder to do that than previously, and that's consistent with the softer housing market conditions. And that's especially so in WA, where house prices have been falling for some time. And liaison with banks suggests that more lenient forbearance and foreclosure policies have also contributed to the increase in longer-term arrears rates. So in the recent financial stability review, we used the bank securitisation data set. So what that is, so we have individual loan-level data on about 30% of all the mortgages in the country. We have a whole bunch, which you all generously provide us with, which gives us an insight at a very granular level into what's going on. And so we can use that to look at how different types of home loans have performed in WA over the past few years. And I'll run through some of that analysis now. So as a lot of this is sort of self-evident, but some of it's not. So as might be expected, loans that were originated with higher repayments relative to income and loans with higher starting loan-to-valuation ratios have had larger increases in arrears in WA. Larger increases in arrears have also been seen for self-employed borrowers who tend to have more volatile income than salaried employees. Arrears rates for investors have also risen by more than arrears rates for owner-occupiers. So investors in housing in WA have faced falling rental income and the highest rental vacancy rates in nearly 30 years, although that started to decline more recently. We've also found that the increase in arrears for interest only and principal and interest loans have actually been about the same. But while IO loans have similar repayment performance to P&I loans, they are more risky for the lender as they lead to larger losses. That is, the probability of default looks like it's about the same, but the loss given default with IO loans is probably larger. And that's because since IO borrowers aren't required to make principal payments, their outstanding loan balance doesn't need to decline over time. And because of this, IO loans increase the chance the loan ends up in negative equity if housing prices fall, and so expose the lender to a loss if the borrower cannot make their repayments. And so in WA, around half of the loans that were originated on IO terms and are in arrears also have negative equity. So half of the loans in arrears that are IO loans are in negative equity. It's about 10 percentage points smaller for P&I loans in arrears. Moreover, IO borrowers are less likely to have buffers in the form of prepayments or balances in their offset accounts. A bit more than 40% of IO borrowers have no buffers of this sort at all, compared to around 20% of principal and interest borrowers. So an interest-only borrower hasn't necessarily paid down the principal, more likely to be in negative equity, generally may not have any other buffer around to help them out if they get into trouble. Some of that arises because IO loans tend to be newer and so have had little time to accumulate buffers, but even when we control for that, that still exists. Nationally, around 15% of loans that are in arrears are also in negative equity. But to put that in context, so arrears are only 1% of the total loans out there, so that the number of loans that are in arrears that are in negative equity is just 0.1% of the total loans out there, 10 basis points of all housing loans. And so the risks that mortgage arrears currently pose to bank profitability are low. Tighter lending standards should lead to lower arrears, but this can be hard to discern in the raw data. One reason is that borrowers' circumstances tend not to change so quickly that they fall behind on their repayments soon after taking out a loan. That is, it takes a while for people to get into trouble on their loan. So newer loans tend to have lower arrears than older loans. So for example, a three-year-old loan is four times more likely to go into arrears than a one-year-old loan. When credit growth is higher, the share of new loans also tends to be higher, so the arrears rate tends to be lower. Another issue is that macro conditions, which also affect arrears, are constantly evolving, so we need to control for that. But when we control for the age of loans and the state of the economy, we do find that more recent cohorts have lower arrears rates than earlier cohorts. So specifically, those loans originated in the past 2 years have an arrears rate that is almost 40% lower than equivalent loans originated prior to 2014. So it seems that lending standards do actually achieve something. The lower rates, so it really does suggest that they have been effective, and the evidence suggests that effect has actually been material. So the point of running you through that is partly to lead into potentially some of the stuff John and Karen might talk about, but to provide some evidence that at an aggregate level at least, the effect of tighter lending standards, more appropriate lending standards, is there in terms of the way that loans have been performing over the last few years. And I hope that's given you some perspective on the recent evolution of arrears and some of the factors behind it. And as I said, the experience in WA provides an insight as to how housing lending in the rest of the country may perform if there was an economic downturn. Now, an economic downturn is definitely not our forecast, but it does give you some idea about how that might evolve. And in the end, the outcome in WA, obviously not good for the individual borrowers, but as given the size of the of the event that's unfolded there gives you some sense about the overall security of the lending stock. So as I said, we're not forecasting an economic downturn. Rather, it seems unlikely that from here, the national arrears rate is going to increase substantially. Improvements to lending standards have placed downward pressure on arrears. And in addition, the recent reductions in interest rates are reducing the interest payments of indebted households and supporting employment growth and housing markets more generally, and therefore making it even less likely that households are going to run into trouble in their ability to service their loans. So let me finish there and hand over to Karen. Thanks.
So we've covered a lot of ground in the last half an hour or so. I do have some questions here, but like I said earlier, we will go to the floor for questions, so be ready for your turn. I might start with you, Karen, if that's okay. And in your speech, you talked a little bit about, or you mentioned close and continuous monitoring program. And I guess I'm keen to understand from you how you see that program's gone. Do you see it as a success? Have there been challenges?
Yep. So the close and continuous monitoring program is effectively strengthened supervision. So it's sort of like sending in some hit squads to do a deep dive. And why did we do this post-Royal Commission? It was really for us to get a sense of what was happening within the entities, especially with the management of non-financial risks, which was very a key finding of the Royal Commission report, but also the APRA Prudential Inquiry. So the two canaries down the mine shaft that we identified were complaints handling and breach reporting. They're pretty good proxy measures for other systems in place. And I think it's been up and running now for 13 months. I think the metrics are that we've had about 70% of working days since we've started have been within those entities. So the four big banks and AMP are the cohort that we're surveilling, supervising. But I think I can say that initially it is a resounding yes to your question. Is it proving successful? And there's a couple of reasons for that in terms of what we would see as immediate outcomes. First and foremost, it's really shifted the dial on the engagement that we're having with these regulated entities. The form of robust discussion we now have when we meet with CEOs and boards is very, very different to what it was before, and largely now because it's based on a very informed evidence base in terms of what we've found. Secondly, the letters, where the frank and fearless letters that we wrote to the CEOs and the boards telling them what the findings were, and they were very detailed findings, we've actually seen them have an immediate impact on the action plans for those entities. A couple of other areas, we've had feedback from the boards and CEOs that it has actually really informed what they're doing with action plans going forward. It's helped us be a better regulator. A really good example is on the complaints handling. We put out some guidance recently on what we expect of all regulated entities with respect to complaints handling or internal dispute resolution. And that was informed live time by what we were seeing in the entities. I think the big finding, though, which is not inconsistent with the two earlier reviews, is that the unnecessary complexity that's evolved in some of these large institutions has meant that the IT systems and the data have just not kept pace with that complexity, such that systemic problems, which you'd pick up if you were looking at complaints handling and breach reporting, just were not seeing the light of day. So CCM is here to stay, and stay tuned. We've got our first report hopefully coming out on the findings and the distributions by Christmas.
Thank you. Any insights into what the next topics might be?
Nope.
I just thought I'd try. So, John, we might move to you. And you talked a little bit about the accountability regime. And so I'm keen to understand from you how you're seeing organisations respond to BEAR. Is it in line with your expectations? What else could they be doing?
The BEAR's been a big initiative for major banks that came into play in 2018, for the smaller banks in 2019. We think it's been a very big positive. And it's not just coming from APRA. We talk to entities, and the message from entities is it's actually been a good process to go through and really nail down who is accountable for what. So that's been really good. Of course, there's always a trade-off with compliance, so you don't want to build something that's really a compliance exercise, and getting that balance right, we always have to be aware of that. In terms of what we've seen, I mean, one really interesting thing for us has been, you know, we have, it is a very big tool for APRA, and there's a lot of powers that go with that, but we do have some examples where we've seen something we're not happy with, and all we've done is really ask the question, who is the accountable person under the BEAR? And just asking that question has elicited immediate response from the entity without exercising any power at all. So I find that a very pleasing thing. But overall, very big net positive.
Oh, good. Thank you. So, Guy, we might move to you and talk a little bit about monetary policy. So with an outlook of lower interest rates into the longer term, do you feel the impact of monetary policy on the economy is diminishing? And do you believe that this is compounded by the way that the banks pass on the RBA interest rate cuts?
No and no would be the answer to that question. So despite many claims to the contrary, monetary policy, I believe, is still effective. It's possible it's slightly less effective than in the past, but it's absolutely still effective. We have seen, you know, its effect through the exchange rate works about as well as it ever has. Its effect in on the household cash flows is about as best as we can tell, working about as effectively as it ever has. So the fact that households haven't adjusted their repayments down in the months immediately following interest rate reductions, that's been true for the better part of a decade. That is, but still, over the course of time, households do reduce their interest payments. The fact they haven't done it in month one after the banks passed it on 6 weeks after we reduced the cash rate which is also what normally happens, isn't any evidence of ineffectiveness. It's something we're very much mindful of, but we don't, on the evidence we have, and we have a reasonable amount of evidence, we don't see anything different to what's happened in the past in terms of household behaviour in responding to low interest rates. It's probably one of the factors contributing to house prices, so that channel seems to be working about as much as it ever does. And then there is this other sector of the economy which borrows money, which is called the corporate sector, which is often ignored in this discussion. And while it may not necessarily generate an increased investment response, if you think about the small business sector, they also are seeing improved cash flow through lower interest rates. So through all those channels, I think, monetary policy is working about as effective. We don't see any reason to suspect it's not working as effectively as it has in the past. One caveat to that is it clearly is having an impact on those who rely on interest on their deposits for their incomes. I mean, that's always obviously been true as we lower interest rates, but as interest rates gets to lower levels, that does seem to be potentially changing. The behaviour there may be changing some. That's something we're very much looking into at the moment. Just to put in context the effect, so we've reduced the cash rate by 75 basis points. So while the banks haven't passed on all of that to the standard variable rate, over the course of time, what we have seen is that people have refinanced to lower rates, so that by now, I think we're up to around 60 of the 75 basis points is reflected in the decline in average mortgage rates. By the end of the year, it may be getting somewhere closer to 65. And so that's because people are recognizing, you know, because there is a gap between the rate on the front book and the rate on the back book, people are waking up to that gradually and refinancing to cheaper rates. And so over the course of time, the pass-through of the cash rate to mortgage rates may not be much different at all than it's been in the past.
Yeah, thank you. That's helpful. So, Karen, we might move back to you. You talked a lot about remediation and remediation outcomes. And I think it'd be fair to say there is an incredible amount of focus on remediation within the industry at the moment. What's your view on how organisations should balance, you know, getting to remediation, driving remediation, with also driving growth across their organisation as well?
Okay. So before I get on to the legacy versus the growth story, I think it's important that we remind ourselves of three things. I was doing a speech at the University of Melbourne last week, and I had a question from a gentleman in the audience saying, you know, why are you focusing on the negative? You know, this is only $10 billion of a market cap industry of the banks of, you know, how many hundreds of billions. And it just sort of struck me that the metrics here tell us why it matters. We're not talking about hundreds of people or thousands of people or even tens of thousands of people or even hundreds of thousands of people. We're talking about 1.2 million, and that's just the beginning, because that was 670 million, and we know that the banks have actually provisioned more than 10 billion. So that's kind of number one that we need to realise. That said, so that tells us that Houston, we have a problem. But if you then look at it as it's all just a legacy and a sunk cost, I think the more mature financial institutions are actually realising that fixing the problem is part of the solution to growth going forward. The growth of the past, if you're playing with not dealing with non-financial risks, will crystallise into a financial risk event, as we've seen. That's number one. Number two is a lot of these institutions were sitting on what we would call toxic revenues. So to the effect that they couldn't identify the difference between a good revenue, a sustainable revenue, and a toxic revenue meant that the boards couldn't identify whether or not. So for us going forward, after having gone through the process of remediation and making sure that you've got your systems right around complaints handling and breach reporting, all of that coupled with what's good business sense under the design and distribution obligations means that the growth story will be a sustainable growth story and a good consumer outcome story. So for us, it's not, don't view it all as legacy, view it as informing the growth path as well.
And do you have a view of how long you would expect that to take?
The remediation? Or?
Or I guess as we move from remediation into growth, a broad view of, do you see that as years? Do you hope that's more like months?
No, the boards that we're speaking to, they're managing both. And it is a huge task that they're juggling. But those that are doing it in a mature way are those that are, in doing the remediation and getting that right, they're using that to inform what the growth path is. And the best example is product simplification at the moment. I mean, that for me is a real game changer post-Royal Commission, because that unnecessary complexity meant that it was very difficult in and of itself for consumers, but also difficult for the entities to be able to identify which products were of value to a consumer versus which were of surprise value to a consumer.
Yeah, agree. So along those lines, we might move to regulating culture, John, just a small topic. And the industry is grappling with how to address the cultural issues highlighted through the self-assessment report into CBA. And there's a lot of debate about how to measure and monitor culture and how to identify practices that appear at odds with your culture. Why do you think organisations find this so difficult?
That's a good question, Nicole. I think they find it difficult because it is difficult. Like, as a leader of an organisation, I mean, you need a time, you need to be pretty determined, you need to be persistent, right? It's going to take a while and you need to be determined to actually make it happen. I think it's hard because organisations have to do it. Like, the board, the executive are responsible for the culture in the organisation. So they have to do it. Where the regulator comes in is where we see, say, poor risk culture, and we will probe boards, and if we're not happy, we will take action. But ultimately, really, responsibility lies with the entity. When you look at what we saw with the self-assessments, so we had a rich set of data, 36 self-assessments came in, and you know that gave us some insights a bit on why institutions find it hard. So, you know, when you look at the diagnosis of issues, some institutions, or in fact many institutions, would rely on one data source to try to assess culture. They might do a survey, right? So, but in reality, there's actually a lot of cultures, right, in an organisation, a lot of ways to kind of gauge it. So a bit more of that on the diagnosis. And in terms of solutions, sometimes we saw, you know, entities would come to a diagnosis, come to a solution, but a lot of the solutions were focused around systems, processes rather than attitudinal change and cultural change. And so, you know, you've actually got to diagnose the thing well, and you've got to have a set of solutions that are fit for purpose. And maybe if you can achieve that, then it'll feel a little bit less hard than it does.
Yeah, thank you. So in your role, do you find it pretty easy when you're talking to boards and executive teams to work out you know, what the culture is and where you need to be worried?
No, we don't find it easy, and our job's not to feel easy about it. In fact, I hope when we go in boards feel we're being a bit intrusive too. So we'll be asking tough questions of the boards in terms of how they think about culture, what is the culture, what is the remediation plan to the extent they've identified issues that need fixing, and how can they be convinced from management that they're on the right track in a meaningful way. And that's how we do it.
Thank you. So this will be my last question, and then I will open up, so be ready. So Guy, staying with the theme of interest rates and a low interest rate environment, what are some of the risks that you can see arising from a low interest rate environment? You talked a little bit before. And what would you need to see in the housing market to be concerned?
Okay, two slightly separate issues. One I mentioned earlier, obviously there are a number of people in the out there who rely on deposit income. So if interest rates are lower for longer and they are unwilling or unable to switch to any other asset or even run down that asset, then that's a clear issue for them. One thing I'm not particularly worried about a low interest rate environment is its effect on bank interest margins. I'm not sure whether some people have the incentive to talk their own book to preserve their interest margins and complaining about low interest rate environments. But one thing, I mentioned it in my talk. So one, I think bank interest margins in this country are actually reasonably healthy. Well, they are absolutely healthy. Secondly, low interest rate environment has an impact on asset quality as well. So it's not just about interest margins. It has an impact on asset quality, which is a first order impact on the profitability of financial institutions. And I think that sometimes seems to get missed in the discussion here. We are setting policy to ensure a strong Australian economy. A strong Australian economy very much benefits the asset quality of those who are lending against those assets. And I think that very much needs to be kept in mind. Related to that, we're talking on the housing market side, at the moment, we are, you know, house prices are rising, but credit growth isn't. As I mentioned again earlier in my speech, we are much more confident, mostly as a result of a lot of the stuff that APRA's done, about the overall quality of the credit which is out there. And so given that, for me personally, I don't think that's something we're a long way from needing to worry about that at the moment, given what we're seeing out there. There is some level of excess which would be a concern, but it mostly comes down to, are we confident that the lending standards are being maintained? And as long as that's the case, then I think that very much dilutes that risk.
Thank you. Okay, your turn. I think we'll have a roving mic, so if anybody... yes, gentleman at the back there.
I'm the person who's been a member for 43 years, so welcome. I've seen a lot of changes. Guy, my first dealing with the Reserve Bank was acting for a purchaser from a governor of the Reserve Bank. Since then, I've had nothing to do with them. But I have appreciated the policy of the Reserve Bank being open and honest in what it says. I sometimes think you miss the personal contact of people who are dealing with you. And Karen, the ASIC has a lot to learn about drafting legislation, regulations. You draft in the negative, and something that has increasingly come into our society today, and you should address that. I would suggest you would try the Gunning Fog Index to all your drafts. It would make it simpler and easier for people to understand. Now, I've forgotten your name from APRA. I'm just...
John.
I have a small APRA fund. Is that going to be publicised? That's what I would like to know.
So the question's to John?
Yes.
thank you for your question. So, I mean, in terms of what I was saying, transparency is going to be a big focus of ours. We will lean into transparency, but everything will be case by case. So if we're talking about a small fund, obvious, and if there were issues, Obviously, we would want to be very, very careful about doing that if there were stability issues. So we would look at it case by case. But as a general rule, we'll be leaning into transparency a lot more than ever before.
Thank you. Further questions from the audience?
G'day, David Taylor here, ABC. Guy DeBell, you said that low over here.
Okay.
The interest rate reductions are just as effective now as they have been in the past. But the retail sector and construction sector are both contracting as we speak. So can you explain why you think interest rate reductions are still as powerful?
I mean, one thing, this has been true forever and a day. So monetary policy works with long and variable lags. So first interest rate reduction is in June. Here we are in November, and the most recent data we have is at best for October. So we haven't, not much time has gone past yet. So I do think it's a question of give it a little bit more time. As the construction sector is contracting, as you said, it's been falling because we've been at an extremely high level. As I gave a talk on this a couple of weeks back, I think I have reasonable confidence that the construction sector will be picking up by probably, you know, towards the end of next year, because they also have long and variable lags, and they've, having built a lot, now they're building less. But and once demand and supply, what demand exceeds supply again, which I suspect is going to be sometime over the course of next year, then you'll see that come back. So it is a question of, you know, we don't, you know, instantaneous gratification, as much as it's desirable and very much desired in this day and age, particularly by the media, does take a, you know, unfortunately, monetary policy does take a little while to get through, and so it is a question of just having to wait a bit of time to see how that plays out.
Thank you. There's a gentleman over here, if we can get a mic.
Thank you. Question for Guy. Guy, look, I hear what you talk about on interest rates, but taking a slightly larger macro perspective globally, I'm an asset manager. We see negative mortgage rates in Denmark. We see a very large percentage of sovereign debt negative. We are not talking about a normal environment. It's probably unprecedented. Where do you see this all ends up? Because clearly we're all running assets in different shapes and sizes, whether it be mortgages, houses. Are we talking deflationary? What are we actually talking here?
So Phil talked about this last month, I think. So there's some big global forces going on around out there. So global savings is high, global investment is not that high. And when savings are high and investment's not that high, then interest rates are going to be low. And that's a global story, as you say. So to some extent, how that plays out going forward is how those two things evolve. So we have an aging global population at the moment. That's putting downward pressure on interest rates. We have a number of factors which aren't contributing it to being the most conducive investment environment you've ever seen around at the moment. There's clearly a lot of uncertainty around the trade side of things, which is having a first order impact on investment right around the world, maybe a bit less here, but certainly right around the world. So until, you know, the demographics force is here to stay for a while and is persistent. But on the investment front, some resolution of that uncertainty and the opening up of other opportunities does at least provide some chance that actually investment picks up. But in the end, the sort of global interest rates that we see are very much, I think, an outcome of those very big secular forces which are affecting both savings and investment. And while ever they persist, then that's the environment we're potentially going to be in for a while.
Can we just have an addendum? And clearly, we're in a different environment with fintech, technology. You know, how does that sort of get absorbed into your thinking? Because, again, it's a brand new. We're getting more efficient in a lot of ways, less jobs. Are there going to be enough jobs to go around?
So, I mean, that question's been around for a few thousand years. And it turns out, and as of today, the answer is still yes, and maybe one day it won't be. But the concerns about technology displacing jobs, I mean, obviously the Luddites were a bit worried about that, but they all have jobs today, or their descendants at least. I don't think any of them are still around. But my point being is that concern has been with us for a long, long time. and maybe one day it won't, but it's sorry, it will be an issue. I mean, there's very much an issue in the adjustment to technological change, but that's been with us for a very long time as well. But there's no, you know, as I said, technology's change has been with us forever, I mean, literally, and it's not clear that today is necessarily any different than it's been in the past. Maybe it is, but it's not obvious to me that it necessarily is going to have any differential impact than it's had in the past. It is something we pay a lot of attention to, but, you know, one of the big concerns out there, and another reason why people are argue that interest rates are low, you know, Larry Summers very much pushes the secular stagnation view. The secular stagnation is somewhat inconsistent with a large amount of technological change.
Thank you. I might look this way. I think I've got a gentleman at the back there.
Yeah. Hello. My name is Rhys Roberts. Thank you for the informative, interesting presentation today. The only feedback I have is to do the next one in Melbourne if you can.
So we did the last one in Melbourne.
Yeah, it was fantastic. Two,
every second year, I believe.
A bigger crowd as well last year.
Yes.
My question is around very serious banking misconduct. You get into unconscionable conduct, border on criminal fraud. And I sent an email just yesterday off to the CEO of CBA, Matt Comyn, about a matter. And the two impediments someone would have to bring legal action usually when you come across these very, very serious legacy issues where families have been destroyed, people have gone from living in multi-million dollar homes to being homeless because of serious banking misconduct. The two legal impediments usually tend to be statute of limitations. You're out of time, a court can't help you. Or just the major financial imbalance of someone having to come up with millions of dollars to litigate against a bank. So for example, a case I did, we had 15,000 documents to go through. I'd send an email, it's read by 178 people in 11 countries. How do you come up with either the statute of limitations, should legislation come in to extend that when you come across serious banking misconduct, and also equality of arms when you come up with bank remediation matters? So two questions there, and for anyone who wants to answer them.
Karen.
Thank you for those questions. Just firstly on the issue of statute of limitations, we are very mindful when we decide to investigate and then proceed with litigation of what evidence base we have and how fast that clock might be ticking. So it's very front and centre for us in how we pursue enforcement action. So we are very mindful of it. But that said, we're not out of step with the rest of the Western world in terms of sort of statute of limitations being applied here. And doing anything differently would require a policy decision. On the other issue that you raised, though, around people being able to finance legal proceedings, I think there's an important distinction to be made between the sort of conduct or misconduct that we saw highlighted through the Royal Commission versus civil matters that individuals might have against financial institutions. So what I would sort of consider to be sort of the egregious conduct that we saw in the Royal Commission, their matters that ASIC is proceeding with now. So it's effectively industry who's funding those enforcement actions. So we've got a large number of referrals and a large number of case studies from the Royal Commission that we're working through already. We've already filed proceedings in several. We've won one or two along the way. So in the old days, it was the taxpayer who funded those enforcement actions. Today, it's industry itself through the industry funding model. I think the other thing to keep in mind, though, is the regulator does also play a role in dealing with the entities for remediation. So where there has been misconduct or breaches of the law that may not in and of themselves result in enforcement or litigation action, there still are remediation and we can make progress there. And I referenced a couple of those metrics in my opening remarks today.
Thank you, Karen. I think we've got time for one last question up the back.
Yeah, Hello, Michael Aaron. I'd like to ask a different sort of question, which is about if banking is the gearbox for the economy, right? Without banking, we have no economy. A critical component is not only credit and liquidity, but is the payment system. And we're going through a major transformation now into digital payment systems. We're going into a world where we might not have cash anymore, currency and coin, but we seem to have unreliable systems in many of the banks and across the industry. And I'm curious from a regulator's point of view, what you're going to do to make sure that if I do use electronic payments, they will be accurate, they will be secure, and they will be on time.
Why don't I start? So, I mean, we spend a lot of time with the banks looking at the systems that they have, and you pose a very good question. I mean, there's a system for now, but there's also, well, what could happen and how can technology link into that? So we have, a lot of work going on with entities as to how to improve their systems. The NPP, I think, is a particular technology industry regulated that will pose new challenges, I think, for industry and how they link into that. In terms of APRA, we're also looking at cyber and how we can sort of protect the systems to make sure that institutions have the right technology in place to battle cyber, and as a regulator, making sure that that's clear as well. So there is a lot of work happening on that. There's no one answer. There's an array of answers.
The Payment System Board obviously very much cares about all the issues you just raised. John mentioned the NPP. I mean, that was an enhancement to the core functioning of the payment system to basically keep it current and deliver a much better service to the community of Australia right across the board, but also very much built with the idea of, you know, resiliency is very much was very much at the forefront in its design. So we the Reserve Bank, run the core of that payments infrastructure, and we invest a lot in maintaining that resiliency, in particular, as John mentioned, in terms of its resiliency on the cyber front. So both its operational resiliency and we have to maintain that system 24/7, 365 days a year now. So we have to make sure that it's operationally resilient, but also, as I said, very much resilient on the cyber front, which is, is an increasing a major challenge in this day and age. Our patching cycle and maintenance is, I mean, I know all of the financial institutions in this world are very much aware of that, but that's a major issue for us. So unlike some of the, unlike a bank, we can't have our system down between 1 a.m. and 5 a.m. on a Sunday morning. Our allowable outage a year is 20 minutes, so that doesn't give us much time. That is very much a challenge which we invest a hell of a lot of time and effort into making sure that at least the core part of the infrastructure remains resilient. And then, as John said, the overlay is that APRA is very much looking at the resiliency of all the financial institutions that tap into that core infrastructure.
Thank you. So that wraps up the panel discussion for today. So please join me in thanking Guy, Karen and John for their time and comments today.